Great. Good morning, everyone. I will say I'm not going to be as animated as Al was. I'm Norwegian. We're known for our stoicism, so I'll do my best to kind of keep you all engaged. But I'm at the University of Illinois here in Chicago, so I also get to welcome you all to Chicago. I'm glad this session is in the morning because this afternoon the weather here is going to be incredibly great for Chicago at this time in the year. So I'm glad that people are here, and I'm hoping people don't disappear too much this afternoon, but it'll be tempting to do so. I'm actually going to, I think, do complimentary to actually all three speakers, Lori and Cheryl and Al, in terms of looking at evaluation and trying to assess themes and those sorts of things. And this also comes out of community transformation grant work, similar to previous presentation. I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues, Bill Baldiga, Amber Uscali, and Dan Canfield. We were the four musketeers in terms of an evaluation team working with our state health department here at the Illinois Department of Public Health on their community transformation grant. I guess I should have said this before. I have no relationships to disclose. And so here in our state, we had a community transformation grant opportunity. As you know, that was funded by CDC out of the Affordable Care Prevention funds. And that was given to our state health department. Our state health department then did sort of a statewide small grant competition, if you will, to sort of subcontract out the CTG work within the state. And the subawardees, as was mentioned earlier, could pick from up to 8 strategies. The subawardees had to do at least 2, but they could do more. And these are the 8 strategies. I think these are fairly familiar to everybody. 3 in the healthy eating, active living, 2 in smoking, and then 3 in the more built environment kinds of areas. So these are evidence-based strategies. And our grantees were asked really to focus on policy change, implementing policies in their local jurisdictions. So we had a large number of applicants. We went through a very rigorous sort of review process and ended up awarding 21 grantees throughout the state. You can sort of see here in the blue, representing about 60 counties in our state out of 102. And this was more focused in the rural counties, so you can see sort of the Chicago area is not represented here. And part of the grants required that the local health department had to be engaged with some type of a community coalition. So this was very much kind of coalition oriented. I think it's always an interesting question when you're trying to do kind of community-based programming and funding with community coalitions. How does the money, sort of the fiscal agency, if you will, kind of work with that? Because some coalitions are very kind of voluntary. They don't have, they're more informal in their structure. And so in our case, many of ours worked with the local health departments. So as I mentioned, they had to do a minimum of 2. This is a very busy slide, but the idea here is just to give you a sense of, if you can see sort of, you know, the populations are fairly small, ranging from about 270,000 down to like 14,000 in a county population that was served by these. And then similar with the grant amount, went from 15,000 per year up to around 300,000. So not very, very large grants. And then sort of the last column there, just, you know, the number of strategies. So they had to do a minimum of 2. Some of them did up to 6 of those 8 strategies. So We were interested in looking at sustainability of coalitions. I think that this is becoming kind of more a norm now, even in some grant funding opportunities, sustainability or having a sustainability plan in your grant application is kind of a requirement. And so I just, you know, I like this quote that, you know, really talks about, you know, we want to develop the capacity in communities to when we have these kinds of efforts and initiatives that they are indeed sustainable. And the idea is that a community would have the capacity to work together to establish, advance, and maintain these strategies after funding happens. So our evaluation question, we were charged with sort of the formal evaluation of this effort, but then there was sort of almost what we looked at as a natural experiment, if you will, because the CDC sort of stopped the funding in the middle of the five-year grant period. I see some people nodding their heads and saying yes, familiar with that. So we were interested in, you know, what's going to happen? I mean, what's going to happen to these initiatives? These grantees went through the whole kind of grant putting together process. They've been doing, we were involved in the performance monitoring, giving us a lot of information. And so we really were interested, well, what's going to happen now? So we came up with the idea to kind of ask them, what's going to happen? You're doing between 2 and 8 evidence-based strategies through your coalition work. What's going to happen? And so we put together a very simple survey. We sort of asked our grantees, could we do, you know, key informant interviews, take up, you know, some of your time? And they said, you know, frankly, we're kind of not, you know, we'll do a survey. They told us that. We were thinking we could do some really in-depth kind of things, but they were like, you know, we can respond to a survey. We really don't feel like kind of, you know, spending more time on this. So we were really happy to get that feedback. So we put together a very basic sustainability survey. We looked in the literature for such, and we didn't really find anything. So if people are interested, I'm happy to share our instrument. I think for this kind of work, be interesting to kind of know across the country kind of what happened to this initiative in terms of sustainability of community transformation. We know, of course, that there was a sort of a second generation of community transformation grants that CDC currently has out there. Some of our grantees applied for those funds, but many of them didn't get it because it just didn't work out that way. So the idea here was to look at what happened. So each of our coalitions was sort of looked at as a case study, if you will. And then we kind of looked for themes from our data. So I'm going to share those with you now. Interesting, the first thing we wanted to know is, you know, are you going to sustain as a coalition working on the strategies that you originally applied to be working on? Surprisingly for us, really 19 out of the 22 coalitions were going to sustain in one way or the other. Some of them actually found that money from CDC helped them to expand on some of the initiatives they were going to work on. In terms of the three that said no, we're not going to sustain, one said that because they had kind of accomplished, they felt, the goals of their grant within that smaller time frame. And then two others said, you know, the lack of resources, we really can't sort of continue. So it was very interesting. We were not sure that many coalitions were going to sustain their work. Very happy about that. Then we asked them, well, what are barriers to sustainability, either for those of you who are not going to sustain or those that are? What are the barriers, though, to sustainability? So, you know, not surprisingly, right, lack of funding is a big issue. even if you're going to sustain sort of, you know, trying to find other sources of funding was found to be important. Lack of time. Again, these grants were really focused on implementing policy. So this isn't sort of intervention based. It's about doing policy, implementing policy. And so in order to sort of build up the capacity to do policy work in a coalition was found to be, you know, the amount of time that that takes was found to be a barrier. Staff turnover, as many of us know, when grant funding kind of goes away, many of our local health department staff, coalition people are funded through those grant funds, so sort of having the staff turnover issue. And then sort of lack of community support in addition. There was a sense that when the communities that they were working with found out that the funding was being discontinued, you know, there was kind of a lot of disappointment, if you will, to put it mildly, within the communities themselves. What are some successes, though, to maintaining sustainability? And we found this to be really interesting. The most prominent theme that came out was the coalition members' feeling of personal engagement with this type of coalition work. Not so much, you know, other things, but that they personally felt very invested in doing this. Whether or not the funding was there or not, they had a very vested personal interest in it. Secondly, community engagement, sort of the ability to you know, coalesce within your community and do policy work through these eight different strategies was found to be interesting for them, success for them. Having partners, of course, we know from the literature, and then just the ability to network that this type of funding provides was also found to be very important. When we asked them about sort of what were difficulties in doing coalition work, we kind of know this from the literature also, you know, just to start to engage different partners that maybe you weren't working with before. Competing priorities within communities, within local health departments. In some cases, it was mentioned earlier, two of the strategies had to do with smoking. And so when you are, you know, implementing policy to restrict people's, you know, perceived right to smoke, this becomes, you know, can lead to some resistance. The time demands and sort of the complexity of doing policy type work was found to be difficult. The loss of funding. So they mention about loss of funding, but it wasn't the most, you know, the most difficult piece of maintaining sustainability. Very interesting. In terms of the benefits to communities, again, sort of building those partnerships between organizations that they hadn't worked with before, because here again, here are eight sort of evidence-based strategies. They maybe hadn't worked in some of those areas in a policy context before, and so sort of having to build those coalitions they felt were very beneficial to the community. Again, engaging the community, and actually seeing health benefits to community members through this strategy. And then sort of the creating policy. So policy, well, that was sort of the aim of the initiative in the Illinois context. It wasn't the most prominent theme that they mentioned in this sustainability survey. What do they need to maintain their coalition in terms of sustainability? Obviously funding, and many of them could use even this smaller time experience to kind of build and apply for additional funds, including additional community transformation funds that which they in this case they didn't weren't able to get. You know, they need additional staff and additional staff time to do this type of work. They needed training. We did do a lot of technical assistance in working with our communities and so forth. And then finally, sort of, what was their overall experience in working through the We Choose Health, which was the name, or the Illinois name for our community transformation grant, they saw, you know, this really helped to encourage collaboration. They needed more time and money to accomplish their goals. The issue of policy, again, was new for many of these coalitions, and so they were interested in doing that as well. So sort of in conclusion, we found that, surprisingly, majority of our coalitions were going to sustain their work despite the end of funding. We found that there was more similarity in sort of the success factors, if you were, or the success themes, and the barriers were much broader in terms of what they said were barriers to sustainability. So that was sort of interesting. And then we had done a review of the literature on sort of sustainability and what are the kind of the key ingredients to that. The most mentioned in the literature has to do with leadership, and that did not come up at all in any of our coalitions in their responses to the sustainability survey. So that was rather interesting for us. Just a couple of quotes I want to leave you with. They said, "We were successful in reaching a large population in our region, but there is much work left to be done, which is challenging without funding. The We Choose Health experience proved to be positive and rewarding. It is our intention and hope that our past time and efforts put into We Choose Health will continue to be put to good use in further inspiring these types of strategies to improve the health of our community." I would say, sort of anecdotally, they were very polite, if you will, in their survey responses to us, but in conversation, you know, there was a lot of anger, frustration, disbelief, and now a sense of perhaps distrust and those sorts of things. Again, these are small rural communities, you know, and it takes a lot for them even to apply for a grant, and then to sort of have it taken away was found to be, you know, really difficult for them. Set of references, I want to acknowledge again my team and the Illinois Department of Public Health and the grantees who were involved, and I'm happy to answer any questions along with the rest of our panel. Thank you.
I'd like to have members to come on up, and if you have questions, you stand and project forcefully. We'll address any questions, comments, and issues that you have. So if anybody have any, are there any questions? We were that clear. Everybody understood everything. And that's just a nice picture of public health. Yes, sir.
That designed power analysis scope and agenda in Los Angeles, they actually have a complete training manual on it. We actually are working on a paper that talks about how you use evaluation to track changes in that. One of the things I did get to say is that the probably the most rewarding experience out of our trying to do this evaluation was that community organizers said to us, and these were like 50 to 75 community organizers across the country, said for the first time they felt like evaluation got them. And so I think that the tool, so there is a tool, we're trying to figure out how to get the paper out there, but then secondly, how to develop technology to make it very easy to do online.
Okay,
you talked about how you were doing comparative.
Okay. So,
is it so, that we are doing? Yeah, so did you do any environmental, radiation,
Metropolitan Economy. Although it is called an office, the entrance directly to the Deputy Secretary of Public Health. It's sort of taken an act of the state legislature in the administration. As such, our emergency preparedness efforts are all added. So if you're at least one to anyone, our office was the lead for the Department of Health and Hygiene, which was the state lead for coordinating the response to H1N1 as also is for emerging infectious disease. If it's a response to hurricane, radiation, improvised nuclear device, dirty bomb, we are supportive of the other state agencies that have had the lead. So if it was a improvised nuclear device that go off or our office and the State Health Department would be in support of the Maryland Department of the Environment. Within the state organization and code of Maryland regulation, Maryland Department of the Environment has authority for radiological nuclear licensing, unlike several other state health departments where that falls within the purview of state health departments. If it's hurricane impact on the Maryland Eastern Shore, we're in support of the Maryland Department of the Environment as well as the Maryland Department of Management. Right now, our office is not our office, but the department is coordinated very closely with the Maryland Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, because as you all know, how the pathogenic avian influenza has been found in flocks from the western and mid-U.S. flyways and has yet to show up on the eastern flyway. The poultry business in Maryland is worth billions of dollars in terms of economic impact. So we're already participating in that activity in anticipation of the issues. Now, I'm gonna make a comment here for everybody. Emergency preparedness as dictated from the CDC and from the HHS ASPR has been focused a lot on pandemic influenza. And it's been my feeling for the past couple of years that any daily emergency preparedness activities should not be focused specifically on pandemic influenza, SARS, MERS, but that the general planning within the health department should be a plan for emerging infectious diseases. Whether or not it's a novel infectious disease, reemergence of multi-drug resistance TB, you should have your general plan with annexes or appendices to deal with specific emerging infectious disease. Correct. I managed to get the Deputy Secretary and our work group to start working for MERS back in the spring, and both of them began. But now we're working on emerging infectious disease plan, but we also have customers now coordinating work on our Ebola virus disease response efforts. To date, in Maryland, in 1 year, monitored over 5,000 return to travel from North Africa. That is one of the final information in Maryland. They get called twice a day, or you're sick every single day, and then depending on their risk, determined risk level, or patient under investigation, it's more critical. Did that give you? So we plan in our office, all have plans. Yep, ma'am.
I said, thank you everyone for the talk this morning. I was curious about second speaker, Dr. Gill, the reception of the term community organizing with some of the groups you work with at Metro in North Carolina, and I know that sometimes the term community organizing can give people scare and they try and steer away from it. So I was curious of your work, how that term was received and kind of that work within both the public health groups that you were working with, as well as the decision makers, and maybe also thinking about in like local government, economic development, other partners that you brought in, how that, you know.
Yeah, so the actual grantees were all chosen because they were organizers. So they didn't have an issue with the concept of community organizing. And then in terms of the public health arena, they really weren't central. Public health posters really weren't central to the process because of the way in which the issue of childhood obesity was being framed around issues of social justice. And that just wasn't the way public health people were thinking about it. And then in terms of the decision makers, they initially tried to dismiss many of the community organizing groups, taking for granted that they really didn't have much of much to say and did not have much relevance and could not bring much power to the table. And a number of them, for example, I'll never forget watching this play out in New Orleans, had to do it about faith. And it began taking them very seriously. And what I didn't mention on the slide where you saw the maps and I was showing the different areas of focus, the latter part of the map when the numbers were coming in, those were actually places that had public policy wins. And so across the 22 grantees, in 2.5 years, because that's the actual amount of their funding, 72 policy wins across the country. So they became a force to contend with. It's a really, it's a sleeper that we're not paying enough attention to, and we're not realizing that we need to let the communities drive the public health process. They know what they need, they know what the issues are, and you know, we are not giving them their due respect.
I really enjoy this, I'm going to advocate for a book that I read several years ago. I heard an interview with the author on National Public Radio, and listening to her talk and then getting the folks to read the book, I think that there's a significant mechanism. We've heard about Adam Murphy is coming about children getting together and getting other children to participate, the health initiatives that we talk here. And the author of the book is Tina Rosenberg. She wrote a book, Joy to Club, How Peer Groups Can Transform the World. She became concerned about her children going in the middle and upper school and whether or not they would become involved in the wrong peer groups. And in her book, she discusses how peer groups come together with common values and mores and ethical values to lead transformation. She gives a couple of examples about students in Kosovo, how students in Kosovo brought about nonviolent political change, how they went out and taught the Egyptian students in Tahrir Square. And she also discusses about peer group formation and its impact on HIV/AIDS transmission in South Africa and adolescent smoking in South Carolina. And I think as a tool or as a paradigm to address social change, policy change, advancement of public health, goals and objectives, I think it's a very powerful paradigm that could be applied with it. So that's enough of my application for that. Any other final questions? If not, thank you for your attention.